share, subscribe, and rate it.
5 stars.
Bigfoot and Beyond.
The greatest podcast.
Wherever you're listening or watching, remember, always keep it squatchy, yeah.
And now your hosts, Cliff Berkman and James Bobo Fay.
Good afternoon, Bobo. How you doing today?
What's up, Cliff? Thrash. Just got back from my 2.5 week film sesh.
Oh, man. You have been gone for a long time. We almost crossed paths a few times, too. You've been all over the Pacific Northwest in the woods filming. I can only imagine you are beat just about to death.
Dude, I'm worked. The last couple of days were pretty mellow. We were at Tom Powell's place, the Tranquil place. So I was just so beat by the time I got there. It was nice. So it was just so relaxing there. And yeah, but I was just run down to the point of just breaking.
Well, Tom's is a good place to recoup. You know, it's like one of those Bacta tanks in Star Wars, or, you know, it's like a Valinor or something where all the elves go after they die in Middle Earth. It's just a place to rejuvenate yourself and heal. So I'm glad you had a chance to spend a few days out there.
Yeah, it was awesome. It's always cool to hear Tom talk.
Yeah. Did you have a chance to do any Bigfoot stuff on the road? I know you were doing all Bigfoot stuff, but did you hear or see anything cool you can share? Or is that all left up to the production and you got to stay quiet about it?
No, we had stuff a couple nights.
Well, I had a pretty close encounter on my trip, man. My museum members know about it because I was filming while most of this was happening. It was a pretty exciting little thing that happened. So I was hiking this little lake up and up, kind of near Lake Quinault in that general area. There's this one little spot that has been producing footprints for the last maybe 10 years, and they're always on the trail. But it's a common place. It's in Olympic National Park. I wanted to go hike the trail just because this is the time of year that stuff kind of comes from, you know, like all the footprints appear this time of year, May, June, and July. So I get up there and it's 5 o'clock. So I know all the tourists are going to be gone and it's getting to be dusk when all the animals are out, and I figure, okay, I'm going to do a little solo hike here, about a mile or so, a little bit more than a mile back to this little lake. And so I'm on the path and I'm hiking and I'm filming stuff for our museum members, because our museum members, you know, if you're a member of the museum, you actually get 2 free documentaries that we make in-house every single month. So I was thinking, oh, that's a great opportunity for some content. So I'm filming it and everything, hiking back on the trail, and I come around this corner. I'm almost to the lake, like 200 yards, 300 yards from the lake. I come around this big rock wall corner, and right there, 25, 30 feet in front of me, there's a black bear standing up on its hind legs. And it was sniffing the air because the wind was at my back. It could smell me coming, but it couldn't figure me out. And like I go, oh, cool, a black bear. And then I come to my senses and say, oh, crap, a black bear, because I'm a mile from my car. Right. And I don't have a firearm on me or anything. I do have bear spray, though. For whatever reason, I was lucky enough to take some bear spray with me. And so we look at each other and I go, get out of here. And that kind of thing. And it kind of looks at me like, well, God, you didn't have to do that. You know, and kind of wanders away, you know, kind of a little annoyed at me. And so I back away by the rock wall, you know, to make sure I can, you know, check if it's coming after me, I'm going to see it and stuff. And it didn't, of course, but I'm, you know, about 30 feet back on the path now than I was. And I'm talking to the cameras, telling the camera and my members what just happened and everything. And then I hear breaking of branches and scraping of bark. And I go, oh, I think it's going up a tree. And then I see the tree move and I, okay, cool, it's going up the tree. Cause I'm like, you know, punishing myself now, saying, oh man, you blew the shot. This would have been really cool. My members could have seen a black bear up close. I can't believe I blew it. And so I peek my head around the corner and I see the tree and I go, okay, well, the bear's up in the tree. I'm going to film the bear. So I step out into the path or whatever. And I kind of walk over and I'm looking up in the tree. Oh, there it is. And I you know, I'm trying to get my viewfinder on it, you know, my camera on it, and looking at the viewfinder. And of course the camera is focusing on all the leaves in the foreground and causing problems. And I'm not getting a good shot of the bear. And when I finally line up the bear in the viewfinder, I'm looking at it and go, that's not the same bear. Oh crap, that's a different bear. And I take the camera.
Was it cubs?
Well, it was a yearling is what it was. It was a yearling. So not quite cubs, but you know, mom. So I saw mom, and then I take the camera down and there's mom. The initial encounter was 25 or 30 feet. And now she's at 35 or 40 feet, far too close. And easily that distance is easily closed by a black bear in a matter of a few seconds. And I see mom and she's looking at me like, what the hell are you doing? You're not acting like all those other humans do. And I just like yell it a few more times and back up. And, it was an adrenaline filled moment, to say the very least.
You ran into a lazy mom. You're lucky.
Oh, I'm very lucky. A pretty well-fed mom too, by the looks of her. She was as tall as I was, Bubs. I mean, I know I'm not the tallest guy in the world. You are, but it was as tall as I was, and it was a very well-fed mother.
The most ferocious black bear mother I saw was 2 years ago up in the Klamath, and it was only about 140, 150 pounds. She had two little runty cubs, and I was in my truck driving. She charged so fast. It was the fastest bear I ever saw by far. And she was so vicious and just snarling and stomping the ground and swinging her paws at us and didn't get within 100 feet of us. But man, it was intimidating. I was like, oh my God, if I was on foot, she could have got me. Like, in literally, like, she could have closed that 100 feet in like 2.5 seconds.
Well, I'll tell you, I backed out for a long time with the bear spray out. The safety was off. And, you know, and as I was leaving, they were making this noise like that over and over again. And I heard the same noise about halfway back to my car, but from the other side of the trail. And I'm thinking, man, there might have been another one around. Yeah. So it was an adrenaline filled, you know, 1 mile hike back to my car. I'll tell you that much.
That's cool though. Yeah. I almost went down that trail like 2 days before you did. I was right in the Quinault.
Yeah. What a great area. Yeah. And then, you know, I spent the next night on that Forest Road 21 on public land off the reservation. Nothing happened out there, of course. Tried to get up to, some little spot up by, in between the coast and Highway 101, but, the road was washed out. So anyway, I had a couple of nights of solo camping. It was really cool. Enjoyed it. Dropped by one of our former guests' house, you know, Robert, that we had on maybe about 2 months ago. Dropped by his house, and stuff's been happening this past week. They've been hearing whistles and things like that on the property.
I was there like 2 minutes ahead of you, and there was whistles going on.
Oh, yeah. It was about the same time frame there. You saw the cast, right, that they got out of their garden last fall?
Yeah.
Yeah, he gave that to me, so I'm going to be cleaning that off and getting a little deeper into it and fixing it, because it was a bad plaster pour, apparently, and it didn't hold together very well. But he's not very practiced in this, which is, again, a good reason for our listeners to try to go out to the garden, step in their own garden, and cast their own footprints for a little bit of practice. But it's okay. Robert didn't make any mistakes or anything like that. He just it wasn't a good pour, and that happens to the best of us sometimes. So I'm going to fix that cast and clean it up and see what kind of information we can pull out of that. So.
And someone in the city is saying, hey, I don't have a garden other than the apartment. You just go out and find a big pile of dog feces and use that.
Yeah, that's the Bobo way to do things. There's cleaner, more sanitary ways to do it. You could just go to a playground or, you know, the city garden or something like that. But if you happen to have enough dog feces lying around, you can try the Bobo method.
Just make do with what you got.
I suppose so. All right. Well, you know, this is our June Q&A. So these are our favorite episodes to do. This is when our listeners can actually write in questions to our email address. But we have a new feature this month. If you remember the last couple of weeks, we've been talking about a phone line that you can actually call us. We won't pick up, by the way. It's just a recording. But you can phone us and actually ask the question yourself, so you can hear your own voice on Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff and Bobo. And we're going to break out that feature today. In fact, but we're going to start with a couple of those questions so we can actually hear our listeners' voices, their melodic tones of their vocal cords. So we're going to start with the first question. Why don't we jump in and listen to our first listener?
Hey guys, it's Mike. Bobo, haven't seen you a while since New York Comic Con. Cliff, just saw you back in November. You know, it was great to see you guys again. And yeah, I've been loving the podcast. It's been my favorite podcast I listen to every week. And it's just so, it just makes my love of Bigfoot just so much bigger every time I hear it. And when we are also going back to Kentucky this year for CryptidCon in November. So I'm hoping that you guys will be there. And Bobo, I got to see my favorite Bigfooter again. So have a good day, you guys, and keep it squatchy.
Okay, I think that's Michael Madden, our very first Finding Bigfoot fan, the first guy that contacted me about the show, and he's been very dedicated and cool guy, and he started off, he's like a young teenager when we met him, now he's a young man, and I haven't seen him forever, but yeah, he's a cool guy, and glad he's still listening and following us.
Yeah, that's great. And of course, I'll be in CryptidCon, I think, this year. I don't know if Bobo will, but you did mention you wanted to see your favorite Squatcher, so I'm assuming you're talking about me, right?
He was, but I'm not going to be there. Sorry.
Yeah, I must be talking about me. I'm kidding, of course. He did direct the question directly to you. So, right. All right. Well, there you go. That's a taste of a way. You can hear your own voice next time. If you do want to submit a question or whatever, go to BigfootAndBeyondPodcast.com and you can follow the links there. So you can, a way you can call in and leave a voice message for us. So,
hello guys. This is Dave Middleton from LA. That's Lower Alabama. I just wanted to start off by saying I love the show. It's so great. Y'all make it seem like we're just hanging out, listen to y'all BS and talk Sasquatch, and I love it. My question for you is, I understand that there's photos and video out there that leaves no doubt of the existence of Sasquatch. Some say it will never, ever go public unless it's discovered. I'm really curious how much of those you've seen that leave no doubt. I'd like your thoughts and comments on what you have seen. Keep up the good work, guys, and y'all have a wonderful day.
Well, there's absolutely nothing better than Patty that I know of, but we've seen that still, those two stills, Cliff, from that one video that the guy we know, the real strange looking one that couldn't be a human.
Oh, I've only seen one frame from that. That's all he would share with me, and he would never actually lend me the picture or anything. So
it wouldn't be a nail in the coffin, like this is final proof at that. It couldn't be a human.
No. There's this one gentleman that got a hold of a picture through his sister's work friend or something like that. And the one still from the video I've seen is just so weird. It's gangly and thin, and the body proportions are way off. There is no way, in my opinion, it could possibly be a suit because a human wouldn't fit in it. There's no way that you could contort a human, even like the strangely proportioned humans that they use for horror films and all that kind of thing. You know, those people who get those gigs, the contortionist sort of people. I don't see how it could be a person. I just simply can't see how that could be a person in a suit.
It couldn't be. And it's about a minute video. It's in broad daylight, unobstructed from like 50, 60 feet away with an iPhone. So, I mean, it's from what he said and how he compared it to the still, like, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, but we'll never see that, I don't think, because he doesn't have the rights to share it. And I think he scared off the witness. The witness was really, really cautious about giving out his information, didn't want anybody to know who it was. So this guy showed up to his work demanding to talk to him. It's like, that's exactly the wrong way to handle these sort of things. But then again, maybe what I heard wasn't correct and he did it with a more soft hand, I guess, a softer hand. But I don't know. And of course, I was trying to, he asked me, like, what do you do to verify this? Well, you go to the site with a rangefinder and you take some comparison photographs and, you know, bring a tape measure and all this sort of stuff. And the response was, well, no, I think I'll just go there and I'll feel things. And if it feels right to me, then I'll know it's a real picture. It's like, oh God. No, don't do that. That's not, you know, your subjective opinion doesn't matter.
He went there and found the site.
Did he do anything beyond that, or did he feel that it was a good picture?
He eyeballed the distance. I think it was like 60 feet.
No, it's unfortunate he didn't do anything further because that was a really interesting, compelling picture. But, you know, the picture's still out there. Maybe someday the owner will share it. So
hopefully he shares the whole video.
That would be fantastic. That'd be fantastic. But
there's some other good photos out there, and I've seen a few good, but nothing as good as PG film.
No, there's nothing out there as good as that because the Patterson-Gimlin film is, you know, 20 or 18 to 24 frames a second. So every second you have 20 plus pictures of the thing. And the way it moves is so compelling. And really, when he was saying that, it was Dave, I think, Dave Middleton, I think his name was, our listener who asked the question. And he asked, like, are there pictures out there that would put the whole thing to rest, basically? And no, the picture is never enough. It's the analysis and the work of researchers behind the scenes digging into the evidence itself. That's the compelling part. You know, you can show a picture to somebody and say, oh, I think that's real, or I don't think that's real. But who cares what you think? It's the evidence behind it. It's the analysis of the photograph that is compelling. It's not what you think about it. Your opinion, or my opinion for that matter, is just as good as everybody else's, which is pretty worthless at the end of the day. It's the numbers. It's crunching numbers and doing the math and squeezing things out of the squeezing information out of the images that makes it compelling, in my opinion, at least. But then I just said, what is my opinion worth? Not much.
That's not an opinion. That's a fact. Without due diligence and research and measurements, it's just an opinion. Yeah, it's just an opinion, like an opinion. We all have one, just like we all have something else.
Yeah, yeah. What do they say? We all, opinions are like buttholes. We all have one and they all stink.
Yep.
Stay tuned for more Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff and Bobo. We'll be right back after these messages.
All right, let's go to the next question.
Hello, my name is David Pearl. I am a Bigfoot researcher and also fan of Finding Bigfoot, and admired you guys for a long time. My question is, have you ever guys thought about having a wildlife vet on your show to discuss tranquilizing a Bigfoot?
Well, with tranquilizing, the reason that's not really a viable option is you have to know the specific weight, what the heart rate is, what their metabolism is. You could make a concoction for an 800 pounder, but you see a 300 pounder, you shoot it, you could overdose it, or vice versa. You make a concoction for a 400 pounder, you see a 900 pounder. All you do is piss it off with a dart. You're not going to, you know, put it down. So it's just not really a viable option as far as that goes.
Yeah. And I think one of the more common drugs for tranquilizing large animals is ketamine, which is a highly controlled hallucinogen, basically, at the end of the day. You need a prescription for it and whatnot. So if you go to a veterinarian and say, yeah, I'd like a prescription for ketamine, please. What are you going to do with it? Well, I'm going to go try to target a Sasquatch. I'm going to go try to tranquilize a Sasquatch. They're going to say that you've already had enough ketamine. Yeah, like you've already had enough. You don't need any more.
Can you imagine a Bigfoot frying balls with a dart stuck in it getting pissed off?
Oh, yeah. Like what if you dose, like, okay, this should be good. And also, we don't know about their metabolism, as you said, their physiology. How fast do they clear their system of these chemicals and whatnot? You know, and apes in general have a pretty slow metabolism. So if we say we use gorillas or something like that, or chimpanzees for a model of metabolisms, and it might be really accurate. We don't know, of course. But what if you underdose it, you're going to have a really pissed off and intoxicated 1,200 pound animal on your hands. That is not a good situation. And of course, it's something you hit a lot of the really good points, Bob. So one of the things you didn't mention is the inaccuracy of tranquilizer guns and darts. You have to be within 30 to 50 yards to even get close to one of these things. And at that point, how hard is it to see a Sasquatch, let alone take a picture of one, let alone get it that close to you and accurately hit it in a good place with a dart full of highly controlled narcotics?
And he's got hands. You can just pull it out instantly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, pretty much. I think I would.
Hey, you guys. It's Michael Perry from Pullman, Alabama. A big fan of you, Cliff, and Bobo. You guys are so funny and so real. So a group of my friends and I had a Sasquatch encounter underneath a man-made dam here in Alabama. I was wondering, how often are reports around either man-made dams or natural dams? I love you guys. Keep it straight. Y'all have a good day.
Okay, so sightings around outflows or dams, whether they're natural or man-made, kind of a lot.
Yeah, a lot. Yeah, reservoirs are a big setting spot. And more the inflow than the outflow of the man-made dams, the inflow areas usually have more activity.
I was thinking the opposite. I was thinking of a Stumpy Meadows Reservoir in the Sierras. Like there are two or three sightings in that real narrow canyon underneath the dam. And same thing at Wainuchi Lake as well. I was thinking it was the opposite. So you think it's the inflow to the lake, not the outflow underneath the dam, huh?
I just read a lot of reports and talked to a lot of people that said, is it the creek that, or the whatever, the main creek that flows into that reservoir at the top end, like where it gets real marshy and stuff like that?
Well, you know what? I think that the commonality here is, of course, like water flowing and also canyons. I think that these things are big fans of steep canyons, steep, narrow canyons.
Yeah, they can get away from anything they want in those places.
Yeah. In fact, I'm starting to wonder if that's not where they're usually hanging out, because, you know, people see them on the roads and trails down below quite often. People, you know, we look at the Olympic Project and their trail camera activities always on the ridges and whatnot, and they didn't really get anything up there. But what area is kind of unexplored and uninhabited by humans? It's the steep stuff in between.
Yeah.
And Sasquatch is looking at their anatomy. You can tell a lot about their behaviors, you know, whether it's the intermembranal index, which is, of course, the proportion between the arm length and leg length. The longer armed animals are inclined, like apes in general, are inclined for bipedalism. But Sasquatches don't have the arm length and proportion of their leg length as the other ape species. It's just a little bit longer than humans. about 80-90% versus the 70-75% in humans. And that would indicate some sort of use of hands in some degree, but maybe not on flat ground as much like the other ape species, but on those slopes. I think that's a really interesting thing, that you could look at their behavior, their possible behavior, and correlate that to their arm length in the way that they might use their arms for locomotion and steadying themselves and climbing and descending and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I've talked to people that said that when they go down those really steep slopes, like the very first tracks they found in 58 they reported, like if you go to those places and look at the canyons where they drop down, it's insane how steep it is. And they also, I've heard from people say they could tell where they got like a flex. They look like their heel might be a little bit flexible, like their heel is digging in like a brake. Have you heard that?
No, but I mean, I know I use my heel that way going up and down hills, so I don't see why they wouldn't, right?
But they said like it looked like it almost like was like a giant big toe. I mean, I know that the prints don't show that, but I'm talking about this, where it's really steep. It looks like they can curl the heel down, like make it like a little bit of a hook almost for extra stopping power.
Well, that midfoot flexibility that they have would be very useful, not only for going uphill, but for downhill as well. Imagine the various ways you can contour the foot shape to accommodate that level of that steepness of the hill as they go up and down. That in combination with their arms, because they've certainly been seen using their arms, grabbing onto saplings and whatnot as ascending a hillside going up. It doesn't surprise me in the least.
Yeah, you know, we actually did an official survey where we were filming for one of the documentaries we're working on. One of the team members had a sighting of two individuals, and we got a full survey of slope grade, distance, all that kind of stuff. So I don't know of too many reports that have had that kind of level of documentation and measurements.
And we'll be able to see that in the documentary when it's finally released?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
It's nuts where you look where they crossed the road, where they came up, it was the steepest part, and where they went crossed the road, went up again, continuing up the mountain, they went up the steepest part again, and there was like, I mean, talking 10 yards either side, there was like way easier pathways, but they just went straight up.
Yeah, they don't care. I don't think they see, and I know a lot of people say, oh, well, we'll put the trail camera on the road and whatnot. I think everywhere's a road if you're a Sasquatch.
People that have tracked them over long distances, a lot of them report that they just point in one direction and go. Like, they don't care if, like meander this way, go that way. It's just a straight line for the most part.
Yeah, Derek Randall's was one of the first people to share that with me. And I know you have as well over the years. But Derek in the Blues he found that out by going to tree breaks. These tree breaks were in just a completely straight line. You know, whether they're 50, 100 yards apart or more. But when he looked back at them, he's like, oh, these are a completely straight line, unless there's some immovable obstacle, like it's just something you simply cannot go around or go over, rather. They're just going to go in a laser straight line to wherever they're going, because there's very few obstacles for a Sasquatch.
I mean, I haven't seen any terrain that's slow that they can't conquer.
No, Moneymaker just posted something that happened up on, was it Highway 12, I think, south of... of Elma. And where that Sasquatch was seen was probably, it looked like to me, there was a photograph of where it was seen, something like 15 feet above the road on almost what looked like a sheer cliff. That's no big deal. I also think about those sightings back in the 70s by Bonneville Dam up here when it was on Highway 14. That animal was seen jumping straight up like a 12 or 15 foot cliff and just kept on going like it was nothing.
Yeah, I talked about it on here, that guy up in Turwer Valley, Turwer Creek up in off the Klamath, lower Klamath. He saw the thing go up like a 70 to 90 foot cliff. Just, it was kind of softer dirt, but it was taking its hand and like Wolverine, the superhero, just sticking its fingers into the cliff face, just jamming them in and rocketing itself up like that.
Yeah. Then one other thing, I remember Robbie, we interviewed Robbie during Finding Bigfoot when we did the sighting above the Sandy River there. I spoke to that guy the day after his sighting, within 24 hours of when he saw it at the same location where he saw it. And that thing ascended this really steep cliff face, basically. It wasn't absolutely vertical, but it was really steep. And he said the thing ran up that hill faster than he'd ever seen any man run on flat ground.
Yeah, it's nuts how fast they are.
Yeah, there are very few obstacles for an animal of that size with that level of strength, so... All right, well, let's go to the written questions. Now, of course, everybody's had a chance to hear some of our listeners. That could be you. So be sure to go to BigfootAndBeyondPodcast.com and go ahead and submit your voicemail to us, and maybe you'll hear your own melodic voice on the air. Okay, you want to take the first one, Bobes, the first written question?
Daniel Mecklenburg, always related to Carl Mecklenburg, the great Denver Bronco defensive tackle. But anyways, what was the best concert you both have gone to and why? What's yours, Cliff?
The best. I always have a hard time with the best because that means the other ones weren't quite as good. And I don't know. Well, of course, not, most people who listen know that I'm a big Deadhead. I've seen the Grateful Dead 28 times before Jerry died, I think. So I had a really good time at a lot of those concerts, near as I can remember, at least. Yeah, it was a good time. But musically speaking, I'll tell you, Steely Dan blew my socks off. Because they're such great studio musicians to begin with. Steely Dan was a fantastic show. I saw them on their first tour out back in, what, 95, 96 or something. First time they'd toured in 20-something years. But gosh, there are just so many good bands. Madeline Peru, gosh, that's another fantastic small little jazz group there. And oddly enough, her guitar player played for Steely Dan, kind of coincidentally enough. Some of the more energetic shows back in the day, seeing Oingo Boingo when in their prime was pretty fantastic. But gosh, the best concert, I don't know. That's just so hard to say. But I gave you three or four that I would put in the top five, so that's going to have to be good enough for me. Hopefully I gave you enough time to think, Bobes. What's yours?
The best concert, best lineup I saw was the Us Festival, and I think it was 82. They had like Bowie, The Clash, Men at Work, like that, you know, the kind of new wave stuff.
Yeah.
That was insane. I mean, I didn't, the sound was good, but I was so far away for a lot of it. And it was so hot and dusty. And I mean, it was kind of miserable at the same time with the music. The lineup was so good.
A couple of my friends played for some of the reboot bands. Like a good friend of mine was, he played for Flock of Seagulls.
Oh, classic. Yeah. I know guys that have done the same thing. Like guys that play with like the Specials and.
Oh yeah. Yeah. A couple of my friends were in the Specials for years.
And English Beat and a few others. Yeah, those older. And you're like, you're that bad now? Like, what the heck? Like, Josh Freese playing with Devo since like 2009, I think, from Josh from Long Beach.
No kidding.
Yep.
You ever see any shows at Magic Mountain?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Dude, we had the passes for two summers in a row, the music passes to go up there. It'd be like a month. They'd put on, like, I remember seeing like the Motels, Oingo Boingo.
I saw Boingo at Magic Mountain a couple times. We might have been at the same show, Bubs. I saw Berlin there. I saw Berlin.
Yeah, Berlin. Berlin. They played there.
We were probably at the same show, Bubs. They didn't play there a lot. So
yeah, they'd play like a month. I think it was each month they'd have two headliner bands that'd play like during the day. Then once again at night.
God, I saw some band called Animotion at that gig. I saw Sparks one time, which is probably still one of my favorite bands. I was talking about them like a month ago on the podcast. A few of our listeners emailed me thanking me for turning them on to the band Sparks after seeing the.
I saw them there.
Did you? Well, yeah. See, yeah, great venue.
I think Psychedelic First played there, and
oh, that's a great. They're a great band too.
Yeah, there's a few.
Now, you know, I, some of these bands, I know that they're great musicians too, because I was in that one cover band when I was living back in Long Beach. That cover, it was a karaoke band. We did the live music for karaoke, and we had like 115 different 80s songs. And it was an 80s karaoke band called Mr. Miyagi. Great band. You and Moneymaker came out and saw me once, and it was a lot of fun. And so I got to cover a lot of these songs, and a lot of these songs are just, okay, they're actually not very good songs. They're just fun, catchy pop tunes. But some of those songs, man, I'll tell you, they're really something, and like good music, like good cerebral music behind that pop tune is pretty cool.
Yeah. You know, I was so glad they finally got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Two of the bands, I forgot to mention, but, two of the bands that I always thought should be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that just got in that were underrated for like how rocking they were was Devo and the Go-Go's.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I don't think I've ever seen either band now that I'm thinking of it. I did play the same venue the same night as Devo one time, but they had the big stage and I was like the restaurant band, you know, but nonetheless. And actually, what, for somehow or another, we almost stole one of their cymbals. It was an honest, absolute accident, and I don't know how it happened. And we fixed it. We returned the cymbal once we figured out, like, whose is this? What? How did this get in there? We found and we went back and returned the cymbal. And when You know, if we were actually going to steal it on purpose, clearly we wouldn't do that. But I think to this day, Devo thinks that we tried to steal their symbol. So, but we, yeah, some of our gear just got mixed up or whatever somehow, even though we were in different rooms. And I don't know how that happened. I think one of the people, like maybe one of the stage hands or something, I think a symbol got loose and we were the first band they saw. So they thought it was ours or something. I don't know what it was, but we returned it. That was a little awkward. It's like when my band isn't being accused of stealing from Devo. Oh, come on, man. Mark Mothersbaugh, he's like an idol. You know, he does great soundtrack music. He did The Life Aquatic. I don't know if you know that movie or not. He did that soundtrack. You know, he's a Subgenius too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, Subgenius. If you don't know what the Church of the Subgenius is, it's my favorite religion. It's a pretty fun one. Yeah, yeah. Where slack is the goal.
I went squatching up in the Redwoods with Jane and Gina from the Go-Go's.
Oh, that's right. You did.
Yeah, Brandon set it up. Brandon Kyle.
Oh, yeah, yeah, from San Francisco. I love that guy.
Yeah, he's really good friends with them. And he's like, hey, you want to go squash with us? I got a couple of the Go-Go's. I was like, hell yeah. Your mate were so funny, dude. They were like, I mean, they've been together for like 40 years. They were like sisters, you know, like just, it was so funny watching them interact because they just busted balls on each other. And they're like, you know, just like sisters.
Well, Bobo, someday we will have known each other for 40 years and we can be like sisters.
Share dresses and stuff.
Exactly. And our cycles will coincide.
Stay tuned for more Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff and Bobo. We'll be right back after these messages.
Okay, well, let's go to the next question. This one is from JD Matthews. It says, hey, Cliff and Bobo, I love your podcast. Do you think it's possible to have a relationship with Bigfoot like Jane Goodall had with chimpanzees?
I think you can have a closer relationship, according to some people. I mean, I haven't, but it seems like some people certainly have.
Yeah, some people claim that. I'm not so sure well, then again, I don't know. Dr. Goodall had them in camp. You know, like she would sit around and they would come through camp and she would allow them to rummage and do whatever. I don't know if that's possible with Sasquatches, because I think if it was, I think there would be more pictures and whatnot. I just think that would be a natural inclination, even though I fully understand that people who claim these things, who claim interactions like this, say that, oh, no, I would never do that to the Bigfoot. Maybe that's true. I don't know.
I tend to believe that. I mean, not everyone. I think a lot of people are seeking attention or just deluding themselves or whatnot. But just some of the stuff they say rings true to me. I mean, I'd sure like to see proof.
Yeah, I mean, I hear the stories. I hope it's true. I'd love to generate some sort of or cultivate some sort of relationship like that. But I just don't know. I mean, you would think with people claiming this as often as they do, which is, of course, rare. But, you know, I think you and I have both heard these things perhaps a half dozen or so times or more. You'd think there'd be a little bit more to show for it than just words from various people, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I don't know. I mean, but you know what? That reminds me, Janice Carter said that she'd be happy to come on the show with us. And she kind of claims something similar.
That's probably the most controversial habituation site case that I know of, like pretty much in Bigfoot history. And some of the stuff that they claim just seems like it's misinterpreted or wishful thinking. But other things just, it's like, God, if that's true, that's pretty mind-blowing what they're saying.
Yeah, and so far, some of the claims, as you're saying, like the Bigfoot knocking on the door asking for garlic in English, I'd have to wonder about, of course, right? I think anybody should be skeptical about that claim. Not saying it's true or not. I think it's important to be skeptical. But the stuff that I've read about debunking all that seems to rely mostly on the incredible claims, which is understandable to be skeptical of, as I just said. And also the habitat doesn't seem to be what the person who was investigating would expect. And I think that's pretty shaky ground. Because if I say it a lot, if there's one thing that Finding Bigfoot, the show, taught me, is that Bigfoots don't give a damn about our expectations about them. They can be found where in some of the least expected habitat.
Oh, yeah. I mean, exactly. Going around the country and seeing all these spots in person and, you know, trusting the people, what they're saying, it opens up the possibility where you're going to experience them.
So I don't know. There's that. So I don't know if it's possible, JD Matthews, but some people claim it And if someday somebody has something to show for it, then I think that'll perhaps open the door for a lot of those claims to be real. But so far, after all these claims and all these years, there's really nothing to show, not even really good footprint casts, honestly. And that kind of makes me scratch my head and keeps me pretty skeptical about a lot of those claims.
Right.
Because you're not hurting the animal by taking a footprint cast. You know, you're just not. And there's nothing, I don't think you're going to offend them by doing it. I think that that's just a really convenient excuse for a lot of these people who are either pulling people's legs or are being delusional about stuff or whatever. And maybe there is some people out there, maybe there are some people out there telling the truth. I hope there are. But like, why should we believe them since there's so many, snake oil salesmen, so to speak, in this field? So it's important to remain skeptical about claims.
Yep. So the next one comes from Christopher Borgman. My best friend and I attended Washington State University in the late 80s, early 90s. My friend actually had the honor of attending one of Grover Krantz's anthropology classes. How do you feel about the value of the work of Dr. Krantz? Take it, Cliff.
I think it's fantastic. I think that he basically forms the bedrock of scientific inquiry into this subject. He didn't have everything right, and then he didn't flesh things out to the level that we have them now. Dr. Meldrum, of course, has gone a little bit further than what Krantz did. But if you read Krantz's book, either the first edition, which is Bigfoot Sasquatch Evidence, or the second edition, which is the first edition is Big Footprints. And then the second edition is Bigfoot Sasquatch Evidence. Same book, except for the second edition has some addendums. I think that that is required reading for Bigfooters. Like, honestly, if I am to take any of our listeners seriously as a self-proclaimed Bigfoot investigator or researcher, and you have not read Krantz's book and Meldrum's book, and probably Bindernagel's as well, yeah, come back to me when you have. I feel that strongly about it. These books form the bedrock of scientific inquiry into these subjects. And that also includes The Scientist Looks at the Sasquatch, volumes 1 and 2, if you can find those. But they're extraordinarily expensive and rare. So Krantz was the editor on both of those, which are basically compilations of journal articles written by investigators on the Sasquatch in a peer-reviewed journal. But yeah, Dr. Krantz wrote about the flexibility in the mid part of the foot, although he didn't have it nailed like Dr. Meldrum did I think you can forgive Krantz. Krantz was an osteologist, if I remember correctly. His specialty was bones, whereas Dr. Meldrum's specialty is anatomy. And Jeff told me that he got his master's degree studying the foot structure of australopithecines. So basically, he is an expert in the foot anatomy and bipedalism, which is, you know, really focused, hyper-focused on our subject here. Whereas Krantz was kind of a generalist anthropologist. Krantz's work on not only the Bosberg footprints, but also the Patterson film and a lot of the Freeman evidence and whatnot, his stuff is indispensable for modern day Sasquatch research. And again, I cannot emphasize enough, if you listen to this podcast and you appreciate the scientific side of things that I think that is brought sometimes to this show, you simply have to read Dr. Krantz's book, followed by Dr. Meldrum's book, and then look at Bindernagel's stuff as well. It is indispensable. Without Dr. Krantz, we would not be where we are today. And I'll say it one more time, the bedrock, essentially, of the scientific analysis of evidence. Before that, I mean, Sanderson collected stories, Hoevelmans did the same, but really the analysis of other evidence that was collected by other people, we have to look at Krantz and his legacy. And I hope that legacy is still going on. Oftentimes with Bigfoot researchers, I kind of look, okay, which one of the four horsemen does this person take after? You know, and I'd say, like, for Dan Perez, for example, Daniel Perez, I say, okay, well, he's kind of a Dehendonite, right? And other people follow in the vein of John Green collecting stories. And other people are more media oriented, perhaps in the Peter Burns sort of way. But I'd like to think of myself at least in the Krantz camp. I am a Krantz-y kind of guy.
And, you know, if like a lot of people always say, like, they want to see the hard science on it. There's the Relic Hominid Inquiry that Meldrum runs out of Idaho State. If you go to isu.edu/RHI, that's where you can still get that kind of analysis.
Definitely have to go to the RHI, the Relic Hominoid Inquiry, hosted by Idaho State University. It's an online peer-reviewed journal. Dr. Meldrum is the lead editor, but there's plenty more. So check that out. In fact, a couple of our guests from the podcast are part of that. I believe Shelley Covington Montana has been brought on as a board member and as part of the citizen science arm of that work. And it's all for free. And anybody can publish in it. You just have to submit it and, you know, submit your paper and get it peer reviewed. At the end of the day, we kind of have to look backwards and tip our hat to Krantz for that. He is the seed that the RHI has grown from.
Good on you, Dr. Krantz. Yeah, it makes me bummed out because, I mean, I was fully into Sasquatch. I just wasn't in the community because I didn't know about, you know, it was before I was on the internet or anything. And I just regret so much I never met him. I talked to Renee on the phone, but I mean, I totally could have, you know, either one of us could have, you know, contacted Krantz because he was so open to people and he'd write back to just about everybody.
Yeah, I've heard that about him as well. I've also heard he's a prolific smoker. So if I would have been happy to take up smoking if I could have like hung out and had a cigarette with him. I don't think he would have appreciated my coughing through the whole thing, but, you know, I would fake it for him. So
I don't think I couldn't handle that. That's a bridge too far for the Bows.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's go to the next question. The next question is from James Wilson. And James asks, love the show. Is Bobo a nudist? Because he keeps talking about nudity and streaking. Bobes, are you a nudist?
Well, like when we'd stay in hotels, as soon as I got my hotel room, I'd always strip down, hang out in the buff. And yeah, if it's warm enough, I'll go in the raw.
Really? Just outside your hotel room, just like in the woods?
Yeah. I mean, if I'm camping somewhere by myself, or as long as there's no stinging bugs, like not all day, just maybe like during peak hours, or like, you know, go for a swim and then dry off natural, just hanging out.
Right. But do you consider yourself a nudist in any way, or you just happen to be naked under your clothes?
I just don't like having clothes on sometimes.
Fair enough. They are constricting.
Yeah, exactly. When you got a body like this, you may as well flaunt it.
Well, I don't know. You and I have shared some hotel rooms over the years. I don't know about that one, Bubs.
Yeah, that was a joke.
Okay, well, I guess that's the short that's the short answer for an appropriately I don't know, there's a joke in there somewhere. I'll just leave that one alone. Why don't you read the next question for us, Bubs?
Bill Smith, you and the Finding Bigfoot crew have been to places where there are known predators like tigers in Sumatra and bears in various parts of North America. What sort of safety precautions did you take, especially on solo investigations? Solo, we were on our own. When we were in bear country, we always had a bear guy that had, you know, a 12-gauge and those flare shots and sprays and air horns.
Well, to clarify, grizzly bear country or brown bear country.
Right, yeah, not black bear, grizzly country. We'd have a guy like that. Then in the Amazon, we had armed guards for humans.
Oh, that's true. That's true. You know, when I was camping in the tiger preserve in Sumatra, all I had were like four porters who had machetes, parangs, they're called in Indonesia. So that's all we had because there's no guns or anything there.
Which is nothing.
Yeah, nothing. Nothing at all. Yeah, but they kept a pretty close eye on me. I mean, I broke away for a little while, but they didn't want me going into the woods alone, I'll tell you.
But if you got attacked, that night when the people started going, hey, there's a tiger growling around us, those porters bolted. Remember? They all sprinted out. They just took off and left us there. Like, dude, if you got attacked, they're not going to, these little 120-pound guys aren't going to attack like a 600-pound tiger with a knife. They'd be out of there so quick.
No, they only came along to report our death to our yeah, to higher ups, you know?
Show where the remains could be, like where the skull could be recovered.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, so not a lot of precautions, honestly. But really, there's not a lot of need for that if you're traveling in a group. You know, the solo camping was the highest risk activity because there's only two of us, you know, Tyler or whoever was filming it and us. But even then, you know, bears and stuff, mountain lion, it's not a lot to worry about if you're in a group of people. You know, I just don't think that's the case. You don't need to be armed.
3 weeks before we got there, like exactly 3 weeks before, those Japanese tourists went out at night for a night photo thing. And that tiger, they said it would have been the same one because that was his territory. Jumped in the middle of 20 people and grabbed the guy in the middle, crushed his skull, and just dragged him off 100 feet off the trail and ate him.
Yeah, I was talking about here in North America, though. Like, tigers are obviously a different thing. And, of course, in Vietnam, we filmed on the Ho Chi Minh Trail where people were in back in the Vietnam War, people were routinely eaten by tigers. Yeah, it was they kept I think it was used because you're really into Vietnam War history. I know that was one of your big things while we were over there. And wasn't it you who was telling me that it was an honor post, a post where like if you were chosen for this post to keep the communication lines open, you knew that you were going to be held in high honor, but you also knew you're probably going to die. Because the tigers there were scavenging off of human corpses and got the taste of flesh. So
I knew about that. But I don't think I told you about that. I think that was someone else who told you. But yeah, Vietnam, man, how gnarly was that trail? Just slippery. It rained a little bit, and that mud was insane. And it was so vertical. And I mean, the fact that they lived out there for months at a time and dealt with that environment and dealt with that mud slipping stuff and poisonous snakes and the rocks would get as slippery as the mud. And I mean, it was just brutal.
Yeah. And going back to the creepy crawlies and whatnot that were, I mean, every little crevice in the rocks had giant spiders in it. Every single one. It was one of the most, and I'm not a fan of spiders. You know, I'm not going to go as far as to say that I'm deathly afraid of them, but looking at an animal like a spider, despite the fact they have eight legs, I do not think of hugs, man. They are creepy as all get out for me. So spiders are one of my things. And everywhere I looked, there was something to be afraid of in Vietnam.
Do you remember we were walking in the daylight and that in Nam, and I walked into that spider web and that huge banana spider swung down on my face, and the top of its legs were in my hairline above my forehead, and its bottom legs were wrapped around my chin and jaw. It covered my entire face, and I just remember seeing it, like I could see those two fang things right in front of my nose, like on my nose, and I it didn't bite me, but I swatted it off really fast, like the quickest I ever moved. And that was a pretty exhilarating experience.
Yeah, no matter what our listeners may think about Bobo, because he does move a little slowly because he's relaxed. But man, when he moves, Bobo moves fast.
They saw the Georgia episode.
Oh, well, you know, yeah. Well, running across that road, sure. But I mean, even then, like, you've got fast hands is the thing. Like, you know, when you've taken those punches at me and stuff, it's astonishing how fast you can move when you need to.
Yep, that's why I'm good at ping pong.
It's one of many reasons you're good at ping pong. Okay, the next one is from Nolan Gasner. Hey guys, what do you think about the Independence Day Bigfoot footage of the alleged mother Bigfoot carrying the baby Bigfoot? Okay, well, you know, I've seen this one, and it's basically a Bigfoot walking and goes behind a rock, and then it picks up a juvenile and walks away. You haven't seen that one, Bobo?
Maybe. I've seen so many videos that almost all of them are crap, right? I don't know if it's real or not.
Well, yeah, that's what it's going to come down to. I'll tell you what, I'll give you my perspective, and you're sitting at your computer. Why don't you type it up real quick and take a look at it? Okay, now, personally, I saw this. I think it's fake. In fact, I'm even going to go as far as to say I kind of think it's CGI. It doesn't look very real. It doesn't look like whatever that is actually there to me. It looks like it was later put in. So I think it's fake. So I just don't pay any attention to it. I don't know anybody who's investigated it and done size comparisons and talked to the witness and whatever else. See, the problem is most of those videos and photographs out there are fake. So anything that crosses my desk nowadays, I guess I've become, you know, a jaded old jerk at this point. I think it's fake. And then until I have a reason to think otherwise, if I'm not directly involved in it somehow, I'm just going to assume that it's BS. Until I find out someone who I know and trust who has investigated it, and then perhaps I can believe it later. But at this point, I'm just assuming it's fake, like most of the other ones.
I'm watching it right now. Let's see. It starts off. You're looking at some boulders on a hillside with some evergreens, and then I can see why people like it. Merging from the right part of the screen looks kind of like a Bigfoot gorilla costume or something. Or it could be a real Bigfoot. I mean, the sun's hitting it. It looks pretty good. I mean, there's some evergreens. There's boulders all around. It's ducks behind some boulders. Pops its head up looking. It looks like it has a baby. The arms look short.
Yeah, I don't know. There's something about the outline of it.
Oh, the legs look like a costume.
Yeah, I don't know. There's something about the outline. There's some pixelization or something. It just makes me feel like that. Maybe that's even CGI. It's hard to tell, you know, especially when it goes in front of the boulders. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's a dude in a suit. But I don't see any reason to think it's real at this point. But it looks suspicious to me. There's something about it that doesn't sit right with me. I've talked about this with another investigator who's experienced in some sort of animation stuff, and he says it's not, but there's something about the outline there that just does not sit well with me. I think it's fake, and I think it's not even there. I think it's a computer thing. Prove me wrong. Show me that that thing's actually there. Somebody tell me I'm wrong. I'd love to know. I don't mind being wrong. I don't have that kind of ego. So
that doesn't look CGI to me though.
Yeah. You know, tell you what, right now I'm going to send it off to my guy who does a lot of this stuff. And so we'll see what he says. Maybe I can report back at some point.
Yeah. I wish someone that was really good at this looked at it for us.
Yes. I'm at the point now where I don't bother looking too closely unless I know the person involved. And it may be, you know, but that's just where the jaded old man in me has come to at this point. So
until it's proven to be real, I usually tend to go, it's fake until proven otherwise. Cause that's what 99.9% are, or the ones that we know are real are so out of focus or so dark or so shaky that, or it's just too far away, too pixelated. Like the ones that we know are real, they're not going to convince anybody.
Well, let's move on to our last question, Bubs.
Yeah.
Go ahead and you can take this one.
All righty. We got this from Daniel Taylor. Hello, Cliff and Bobo. Great podcast. For such an elusive, wary creature, why are the majority of sightings road crossings?
That's where the people are.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot of it right there. Not all of it, but that's a lot of it right there. It's where the people are. Because to have a sighting report, you have to have a Sasquatch in the same place as a person. And that happens where the roads are and the trails are and that sort of thing. Now you might want to ask why are Bigfoots there? And I think that, that answer is pretty clear as well. They're going somewhere, or roads are one of those rare places in the woods where the sunlight reaches the forest floor, and wherever the sunlight comes down to the forest floor, that's where, the animals hang out because that's where the most nutritious plants are. So think about deer and rabbits and whatnot. They're always on the side of the road. And that, I think, is part of the reason that Sasquatches are also in those same areas. Now, you also might want to consider roadkill. There's a lot of free food lying around on the side of the road, let alone like half-empty Dorito bags. So I think that some of those things are all kind of, they all add up to why Sasquatches are seen along roads more often than anywhere else. So go buy a game camera.
I think it's more of them crossing the road than hanging out near the road is what I think. But yeah, I mean, it's because when you're hiking or doing anything else, you got to keep your, you know, you're watching the ground. And to see one on your out hiking or something, unless it crosses right in front of the trail, you got to be looking up and see something camouflaged in the brush, however far away it is. But when you're driving, you're focused straight ahead. And that's exactly where it walks. It's straight ahead of you if it's crossing the road.
Yeah, that probably has a lot to do with it too, where you're the spotlight of your attention is lying, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good question. But the fact that so many sightings are on sides of roads indicates that anybody who is interested in Bigfoot at all should get a dash camera, get a dash cam. If almost half of sighting reports happen on the sides of roads, why wouldn't you get a dash cam if you want to get Bigfoot footage? Think of all those road crossing sightings. If half of the hundreds, if 1% of the hundreds of people who have observed a road crossing of a Sasquatch, we'd have footage. We'd have a bunch of footage at this point. And so step it up, man. Spend $60 on Amazon or something and get yourself a dash cam. If you're really into it, spend a couple $100 and get a really good one for low light conditions. But we as a Bigfoot community should all have dash cameras. And when you get footage, you can thank me.
I think if you buy one of those cheap $60, $80 ones, it's the same thing as buying like a FLIR TK Scout. It's you get that once in a lifetime where it's right there, you got it in frame. But like with the Scout TK, it's such a inferior piece of, I mean, it's cheap and easy to buy, but everyone I know that's bought one of those that actually saw something totally regrets they didn't spend twice as much or three times as much and got something that could document it, what they saw, so much better.
Yeah, I guarantee that if you get footage on a dash cam, you're going to wish you had better. That's absolutely true. But I'm going to push back on you a little bit on this one, Bobes. Think about all the footage from Russia about 4 or 5 years ago when that giant meteorite came down and exploded.
Oh, yeah.
Think of all the different dash cams that captured that. You can't plan for that. And that footage wasn't so bad. And if they can afford that kind of dash cam in Russia and China and all these places like that, where the population, the culture of the population is more inclined to have dash cameras. Here in America, we don't do it for some reason. But in Russia, and I think China's a real big country on that. There's probably a handful of others, like the Eastern European countries. A lot of them have dash cams all running all the time. I don't know why.
Oh, because there's so much insurance fraud and stuff.
Insurance fraud, is that it? Okay.
Yeah, well, people sue them, say, you ran into me, and, you know, and they'll cause accidents and whatnot.
Well, I guess wherever insurance fraud is rampant, we should expect to get a lot more dash cam footage of these things. But the fact that we got a meteorite, you can't plan on that. It's just as predictable as a Bigfoot road crossing. And think of all the cameras that got it.
But that wasn't low. I mean, something crossing low light. I mean, just think of all the deer and stuff you see crossing the road and that you don't get a very good look at because it's the edge of your headlights or something. Whereas if you had a good low light dash cam, those low light conditions, you'd get a much better. I mean, you'd be like, that's the best money I ever spent.
Yeah, but a lot of people are on a pretty tight budget too. And I think that even the $60 and $80 dash cams at this point in time, in 2022, are going to be better than the Georgia dash cam police video of that Sasquatch crossing the road then.
Probably.
Yeah, get what you can. Don't spend more than you don't take food out of your family's mouth or anything, but get whatever you can afford.
Hey, Americans are overweight. Their kids will be good on a few less calories for a week or two.
I suppose so. But you always have an enlightening point to bring to bear, which another reason I appreciate you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that was the last question for this episode of Bigfoot and Beyond with Cliff and Bobo. Thanks for tuning in to the Q&A. And again, just to reiterate here, if you have a question for us, you can either type it in for us or you can go to the website and record a voicemail for us and ask us in your own beautiful, melodious voice. Go to BigfootandBeyondPodcast.com and follow the links and submit your question or comment, and perhaps still hear your voice on the air. I'm going to be in Alabama. I'm going to be in a place called Oxford, Alabama, the weekend of June 10th and 11th. I don't know if this is going to come out before then or not. And if it came out afterwards, I hope everybody had a good time. But yeah, for the Alabama Bigfoot Conference. And if you want to go to the website, it's BamaBigfootConference.com. BamaBigfootConference.com. And this is the first one, and I think it's going to be a great event and continue to happen year after year. So I'll see whoever shows up out there.
Oh, cool. That sounds fun.
Yeah, should be a good one.
So I guess that's it, Cliff.
That's it.
All right, folks. Thanks for tuning in and listening. We appreciate it. And until next week, keep it squatchy.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Bigfoot and Beyond. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us on iTunes. Subscribe to Bigfoot and Beyond wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Bigfoot and Beyond Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Bigfoot and Beyond, that's an N in the middle, and tweet us your thoughts and questions with the hashtag Bigfoot and Beyond.